This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Hello, and welcome to War with a Mate, with me, James.
Me, Andy.
And me, James.
Doubling up there, are you?
Yeah, that way I outrank you. There's two of us, and only one of you, Andy. How are you going to deal with this one?
Well, that would make me the officer, and you're the proletariat.
No, that would make you...
You're the unwashed masses.
I'm the loud majority. Hear me roar.
There we go. So yeah. We'll let you get that out of your system.
You knew it was coming, didn't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm never going to...
We've done enough of these now.
Yeah, I'm not going to leave that Chekhov's gun unfired. Well, it's War with a Mate, the game in which we play the podcast.
Yep, we're playing SPI's campaign for North Africa.
We are. It's a board game, not a podcast. That was a little joke that was born out of a mistake. A bit like this podcast. We are currently hurtling towards the end of Upstage 2 of Turn 3. And the big battle is upon us, Andy.
Yeah, I guess before we get into the details, you were pretty down last week. How's your energy and thoughts about the game this week?
Well, I came into today a little bit more awakened, ready for the game to evolve, and evolve it did. I came in with a renewed sense of potential that the game may have, and it did deliver. It has delivered bloodshed. It has delivered tears. It has delivered less tedium than usual, and instead we have had quite the conflict develop today.
Yep, my movement phase, turn three, upstage two, and had some divisions smashing into each other.
We did, big colliding divisions all over the shop up north, along that northern road, Egypt.
I mean it is.
The Egyptian road along the coast. So, we had a battle there. It was my big wall up at the top, the Trivoli Regiment, which is tanks, the 1st Libyan Division, and the 63rd Serene. I think it's Serene, or Kirene. It's a C-I-R-E-N-E. Another consonant, please. Serenity. Now, that's a film. Firefly
it's a
spin-off
good film.
It is. I'm a fan of that, a fan of Firefly. Took a while to watch it. Did you know when they released that initially, it was released out of order on television?
Yeah, as an episode 2 was released as episode 1 or something.
Yeah, they released it out of order and then wondered why it went bad. You wouldn't do that with anything else.
I mean, no, you wouldn't.
We should with this, actually.
We'll start batch recording them and releasing them at random.
Yeah, we should have released episode 5, like, today.
Kept them on their toes.
Releasing this one as episode 1 would be fun. Little teaser for what's to come. Just would have meant doing this for a long time before we actually started releasing it. Which we did anyway.
Yeah, might have worked out.
But the battle commences up north with those three on my side. 63rd Serene, 1st Libyan and Trivoli Regiment. And you had quite the cluster.
Yeah, it got a bit messy there. But for Serene, because that was the first battle, I had 4th Indians supported by, I think it was the 2nd Royal Tank Regiment. It was. And the 7th Armoured Division, the 7th Royal Tank Regiment, went and joined up with them. And they went in on that Serene Division.
And it went swimmingly for me. Crushing victory on my side, I believe.
Yep.
Oh, just checking my notes.
It was 25%, was it?
Yeah, sorry, now I remember. I was overrun, I believe the technical term in the game is. So, the close combat occurred. We matched up along this northern road. You boxed me in a little bit. You had a bit of a flank going on. Had me in a bit of an L shape on the hexes. Had me on the ropes. We had to begin combat with the option of a barrage. I went for barrage. I took aim at one of your groups, and I managed to successfully pin.
Yes, you pinned one of the infantry units in the 7th.
I did, hoping to adjust the combined arms rules so that I could take off some of your capability tanks-wise.
Which you ended up doing, but...
To no real avail.
Yeah, and then I barraged back and got your single armor unit
pinned. You did, and that was a heavy hit for me. See, when I was calculating the strength of the 63rd Serene, it was with one of the infantry already pinned from earlier, as well as one of the guns already pinned. That was from your air bombardment. So that left me in a bit of a poor position of already being down some men. And then when you managed to pin my tank successfully, that was a heavy hit, because that took off another 16 raw strength points. Now, that was out of a total of 70, which I had going for me. Bring it down to 54. These raw strength points are then distilled, dividing them by 10, into the actual strength points, which meant that's 5.4, and unfortunately, rounding down, that brings it to 5. So you took it down by 2 full actual strength points by pinning that armor.
It's a big hit. The armor punches so much above the weight of the infantry.
It does. The toe points tend to be fairly high. You're talking 8-9 toe points usually. And as well as that, they tend to have 2 or sometimes even 3 on their close assault or defense.
Yeah, most of mine have 3 in the 7th.
Yes. So immediately, that is a huge hit to me. I'm losing a huge chunk of my capability.
Because the combined arms you previously, because of the way that I've had the 7th structured with not much infantry and a lot of tanks, you've been doing the barrage of the infantry so that the tanks can't get involved. But you had, like, was it 8 infantry or something in there?
I had 8 or 9 to begin with. You had 1 pinned.
Yeah, so I was like, I'm not going to... I mean, that's an insane amount of ammo to try and pin 8.
Yes, because a barrage, a single toe point of barrage requires 4 ammo points to be used. And ammo is relatively scarce when you're doing something like that. A heavy truck, a single heavy truck, can carry 4...
8?
Is it 8? Yes, 8 units of ammo. And, yes, you've got 2 barrages, 2 toe points of barrages per heavy truck. So it's expensive to start barraging willy-nilly.
Oh, yeah.
And if you want a guaranteed barrage, you need to be able to drop something like 140 raw barrage points distilled to 14. That's the only point where you can start guaranteeing that you'll pin when you drop a barrage. And if I used all the ammo that I had and managed to have every single gun in the 63rd fire off a barrage, I'd still be about halfway short of guaranteeing a pin.
I do like this ammo being scarce feature, though, because it was like, my plan in this segment was to sort of slam my divisions into you and sort of break that clump up, maybe get a division or two retreating, like, yeah, inflict losses. But at the same time, I'm like, you are next upstage, you could come back in. So conserving ammo for the next upstage while also trying to inflict heavy, like finding that balance is like a good tactical element to the combat.
Yes, which is something I exercised for the first time ever, I think, when it came to barrages. Because I looked at it and I thought I could drop a small barrage with the hope I can pin a unit or two and take off some of the combined arms. But realistically, I could have split it across 11 different barrages. I had the ammo for it.
Just do 1 barrage point on all of them.
Yeah, a single barrage point on each one, which means the roll is something like it's only between 50, 51 and 66 is a success. So the chances are very slim. It's possible, it's just very unlikely. And I was like, well, I can do that and splurge all my ammo, but I'd rather keep the ammo because a single barrage is also the same as 4 toe points of close assault from infantry.
Which is more useful, probably.
In the long run, if I'm trying to hold you back, if I want to keep my foot in the door when it comes to this fight, as long as I'm not getting pushed too far back with retreats, then I can keep that fight going a long time with stuff like that. So I decided instead, no, I'll hold back, I'll keep the ammo, and I'll fight another day. Instead of running out of ammo now with a barrage, that's probably not going to work.
Yeah. You take the free cohesion hit, don't you?
When you lose.
Yeah.
I know you gain three.
If you're forced to retreat, you lose three.
Yes, if you're forced to retreat, you lose three.
If you retreat, I mean, you also lose it if you just decide to...
I don't know if you do if you retreat before combat.
Sorry, retreat before assault, you don't. If you retreat because you didn't put the units in or everyone was pinned, you do.
Yes, yeah. If it's forced. Yeah, if it's voluntary, I don't believe you do. If it's forced, you have to. So yeah, I'm taking hits from cohesion, which is not ideal either, because then that affects morale, which affects the differential, which affects losses and makes it more likely that you'll retreat. And then it becomes a cycle.
Big effect on the result.
Yes, morale is a huge impact on the result. It changes the column that you're rolling in.
Which is the equivalent of you having an actual strength point, which is when it's divided by 10. Is like you have to put 10 infantry in, for example, to overcome one minus morale.
Yeah, and most of my infantry are 7 toe points with one strength point. Yeah. So you're looking at a battalion and a bit in order to balance that out. That's what morale is worth. And most divisions only have 8 to 9 battalions of infantry. So it's a significant portion. It's like a 10% boost.
Also, because morale you have at the start of the game, and that's pretty fixed, although you can increase it with training. But if you've got less than 0 morale, you have a chance. If you have 0 or less morale, and your cohesion starts to drop, you very quickly get into the automatic surrender territory.
Yes, that snowballs way quicker than I realized.
Yeah.
So you got to watch out on that cohesion, because that is killer. And I do have some units, when I was looking over it earlier today, that are in the -3, -5 area. So I need to be careful with them.
Yeah.
There are some, however, where I've been sat doing nothing with them, so it ticks up.
Doesn't go past 0, though.
Doesn't go past 0.
But it gets rid of the
fucking minus. So
it's like 5 if they don't do anything for a whole ops, or is it a whole turn?
I don't think it's 5. I think it's 3.
Yeah.
Might even be 2. I did it last turn, so I need to have a look. I'll double check. But I know I've got another one lined up. There's a unit I haven't moved for 2 turns.
Oh,
who'll get a boost from that.
Yeah.
So I'll see how that goes.
Because my 7th Armored Division are on +9 cohesion now.
That's insane.
Just won 3 battles.
What does it max out at?
I mean, once you get to 10, it stops having an impact.
Yeah. Does it stop having an impact or does it stop you adding it? I imagine it stops you adding it as well.
Probably stops you adding it, but definitely the table
goes up to 10.
Stops, yeah.
Because it'd be wild if you could keep that ticking up to like +70, and then it just means you've got the room to lose so many battles before there's any material impact.
Because when you stretch your units, you spend cohesion. If you got too far, you could have like 20 cohesion and then burn it, and just a unit has an extra 20 CPA for that turn, which is a lot.
Yeah, you know what? I keep forgetting that. I keep forgetting the cohesion boost is also extra movement.
Yeah.
For free, with no real cost.
Yeah. You lose it, but it's like you're just losing a buffer.
Yeah, you're losing something you didn't start with anyway. And you can realistically, if you're using that to push something, it might well be that you earn another 3.
You get your 3 back, yeah.
So, that's scary. I didn't realise how high up they were, but they did have some real good strings of combat.
Yeah. It also means if you're in a situation like we were, where there's a lot of clustered things, it's 5 CPA to attack. You could just see the winning gets you 3 CPA back, if you're willing to just immediately spend them to keep the fights going.
Yes.
So it's like, yeah, you do have to force the retreat, but if you do, you get like a cheap free combat almost.
Yeah, so it's well worth the cost, I would say anyway. There's a big storm of combat brewing around that north coast, because that That combat ended devastatingly for me, because that differential with the morale, with the pinning of my armor, all of that resulted in a difference where I had 54 raw, so 5.4, so 5. And what did yours come out at?
136 raw, and then my morale was better as well.
So 13.6, so 14. So that's already a difference of 9. And then your morale shifted. So it went up to 12. And 11 is where it becomes an overrun scenario. So I was overrun. I wouldn't have been if I had my tank still. It would have instead been 10, so just below overrun.
But maybe not a retreat. It might have been a tit for tat, like chipping each other down like 10% each as opposed to...
Yeah, because I did 0% damage to you. You didn't lose anyone. I lost 25%. 75% of that 25 were taken as prisoners.
So I ended up with 11 prisoner points.
Yes, because I lost... that 25% equated to exactly two full battalions of men. Which was a heavy hit. Because when I'm looking at 8 battalions of men, I've lost exactly a quarter of that.
Yeah, which is rough.
And because I was overrun, that also meant factoring in the guns that were in back positions.
Yes, because if you get overrun, it's everything, not just what you committed.
Exactly. So everything was counted towards that. That could have been pretty bad.
Really rough, because you could put like 30 points in, but then you've got like 70 that take the damage.
Yes. Well, I guess... Oh, no, because I'm defending. I was going to say, if that was an offensive move, then it would be considered a probe if it's less than 50.
Yeah.
But I'm defensive, so it wouldn't be. Yeah. So all in all, that was pretty terrible. I did 0, you did 25%. I also was forced to retreat on the back of that, so I got pushed back. I think I moved 4 hexes instead of 3.
Yeah, I think your minimum, because we were in the 1 hex, because depending on how well you do, they have to... retreat a minimum of 1, 2, or 3.
Yes.
I think it was in the 1, but you decided to pull back.
Yes.
Further.
Yeah, I did not want to stay hanging around for the inevitable next leg of this fight. So instead, I dialed back. I've pulled back onto map C. So the wall has pushed itself back a little bit. The rest of my men were then advanced on by your guys.
Yeah, did a little... shuffling around, some guys detached and moved. It's become a bit of a mess, but basically ended up with 3 divisions, although the 2nd New Zealand is way understrengthed, with then an additional unit on them, because depends per tile, but the average tile you can have 6 stacking points in.
Yes.
A division is 5 stacking points, and then it goes down, so you can have a sort of a division and a battalion or company in the same hex. So I sort of spread that out. So it was as much as I could bring to bear.
And it was a very good tactic, because I was looking at it pretty intimidated. The way you'd structured that was very well done. So I ended up on the back foot massively. You came in with another mighty push against the Trivoli Regiment, and also, which are the tanks, and also the 1st Libyan were getting bombarded by your naval fleet.
Yes, because the ships were there to provide some coastal support.
And provide they did.
Yeah, and because they just have a number on for... They have like a number slash and then another number, and that's their barrage and anti-air. But they just... That's the actual.
Yes.
They don't divide it. It's just that is how many you get. So I think it was 2 cruisers and a destroyer I sent to that one, but ended up being 7 barrage points.
Yes, you hit them with 7, and amazingly, nothing was pinned.
Not in that one. I did 4 barrages overall and got 1 guy.
That guy, though, you say 1 guy, between those 4 barrages, which were 2 on the 1st Libyan and 2 on the Trivoli Regiment, the Trivoli Regiment was one that was hit, and it was a unit of tanks that were taken out. That unit of tanks was then stuck pinned, while everyone else there, the 3 units at that wall, pulled back. So that was the 1st Libyan, the Trivoli Regiment, and who else?
The tank one.
That was
armor.
That was Trivoli. Who else? Oh, sorry, the one I'm forgetting is Bardia. Bardia's garrison was also there. The one with 10 guns.
Yeah, that's a lot of guns.
It is, 10 guns and 4 infantry, as you found out. Yes, of course, that was the fourth unit that I had in there, fourth group. So they all pulled back to be more or less in line with the 63rd Serene. The pinned group from the Trivoli Regiment, they had to hang behind, and they were accosted a second time. And as part of that, they took a retreat.
Yes, because if you're even no ammo or everything's pinned, you don't like do a massacre. They just retreat automatically.
Yes, you can have them retreat. Or I could have voluntarily surrendered.
Yes, that's your other option.
But I thought, I'm not going to voluntarily surrender what is a significant amount of tanks.
Because that's the thing as well. You can use the other person's tanks. You just need to send them to a repair place and then they can attach to anything that can take tanks.
Yeah, and I don't want you to have... Because it's not a small amount of tanks.
Yeah.
I want them to be on my side. So I've pulled all of them back. We're now all... Well, all of my guys are back on map C.
Yeah, there's like a 4-hex buffer being created again.
Yes, which is kind of what it was prior to this. However, it is a buffer that I can cross again if I want to.
Although, correct me if I'm wrong here, but those guys will be pretty tapped CPA-wise from this op stage because of the being in combat is free as a defender, and then you have to pay for the retreat movement.
I retreated before combat, before assault, for the infantry in some of them, in most of them.
Oh, but so you do still pay the movement.
The movement I did, yeah.
And do you pay the break-off price or something? There's a price associated with it, isn't there?
To break away if you're not in combat, it's 2 CPA.
Yeah, do you have to do that as part of retreat?
Yes, because we're fighting, so we're in contact.
So they didn't spend the 3, but they spent the 2 and then the movement. So they probably spent maybe about 10, I'd guess?
I think it was 7 overall. Apart from the ones that were barraged.
Yeah.
Because undergoing a barrage also costs CPA.
Yeah.
So some of them are going to be a little worse for wear, but because you can push infantry to 50% over what they have overall.
You could come back in.
I could come back in and make a push for the rest of this op stage. Yeah. It means overextending and taking a cohesion hit.
Before the fight, which is...
Yes. Yeah, because that would then stack over for the actual combat.
Yeah.
So it's risky. It's not maybe the best option I have, but it is an option that I have.
I think the morale gap caps as well.
I want to say 4.
3 or 4, yeah.
Yeah, that might be right.
So you can't end up with like an 8 differential from...
Morale alone.
Yeah. It would be good if they push their cohesion drops and then they do the auto-surrender thing.
No, it wouldn't. Not for me.
I'd be a fan. Oh, they've come back to surrender.
Well, I think there's definitely risks involved if I do make a push. I do have a plan.
That's good, because I had a bit of a victory here, but I've basically concentrated my entire army to a single like spear point.
Yes, you have to... I think realistically, you have to keep it this.
Probably. I can't be like detaching... Because you've got the 3 divisions down south at Fort Magdalena.
Yes.
That I don't want to fight with a single division.
Yes.
And I don't want to send single divisions after the retreating guys.
So you're going to have to either commit to the bit and go whole hog, or lose a lot of momentum by stopping now and then pulling back and reorganizing.
I do have a rough plan, which I guess is that if things go well for me, I want to take at least Bardia, maybe Tobruk as well, before the end of next turn, which means I have 2 turns, turn 5 and 6, of no one involved having supplies.
Yes.
Because if they don't get fed, they can't enter an enemy zone of control, which means they can't attack.
Yes.
Same with water and stuff. So if I can destroy that supply situation... You could have as many guys as you want, but if they won't go into combat...
Well, they can't enter your zone of control.
I could attack them.
Yes.
But if I know.
Which you'd have to, because around that area, even if I didn't want to, because of the maneuverability in that little ridge that we're in along the north, if I wanted to have them pull back a little bit, it's still going to become a bottleneck, whether I like it or not.
Yeah.
Where that's going to be the area you push through, unless you go for a massive swing down south and go through Maddalena.
Yeah, but then I'm fighting those guys who you've said are fed fairly well now because you've refilled that supply dump.
Yes, so you're looking at having to tackle that, and also you're then moving through track across open desert, and your supply lines do not account for that. Your supply line is a straight back and forth along that road, and there's no supplies down there for you to capture. So my bad supply situation almost
would be my bad supply situation.
Yes, because if I make a push against you, I'm gaining supplies every time I make a push. If you make a push against me, there's nothing to get from it.
I mean, that supply dump that I guess we'll get to it, but that's there.
Yes.
And if I get to Tobruk or Bardia, there's no supply issues because of coastal shipping.
That's true. I guess I stop shipping to them going forward, but...
But I can Commonwealth ship a certain amount.
Yes.
But I just haven't been at the minute because I don't have a port, technically.
Exactly. So, yeah, you taking Bardia would be a crushing loss for me. I don't think you'll take it anytime soon.
I think it's also one of my win conditions.
Yes. I can't see you taking Bardia. Not by the end of next turn. There's too much for you to cut through. I'd have to move my men completely out of the way for you to do that, because anywhere they retreat to is just going to be a box around Bardia.
My thinking, though, is each time they retreat, they get the disorganization points. They burn CPA when you're the non-phasing player, which limits what they can do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if there's like a cascade of like lose a fight, lose another fight, and it just becomes more and more like less resistance from it.
Yes.
Then there's a chance.
But that would mean the same units losing the fight consecutively.
Yeah.
I've got enough units where I don't have to have the same one fight you every single upstage. I can cycle through plenty. I can have one division go up against you like the 63rd did just before. I can lose a quarter of that. I can be overrun. They pull back. I've got another seven divisions that I can just cycle through. And if they're only losing a quarter every time, you'll time out of op stages before you get anywhere.
Well, they're getting overrun, then they lose 25%. 25% more of an overrun.
Yeah, but still.
But I know what you mean.
It's not going to win me the scenario by doing that, but I've got at least... It lets me feel more comfortable playing around with more offensive measures, knowing that if I wanted to go full defensive, you can't realistically break through that wall if I wanted to just completely stonewall you.
Although I don't know about you. I think, sort of matching what I've learned in the history as well, one-to-one, my divisions outmatch yours.
It seems like that might be the case in the game mechanics as well, possibly.
I mean, maybe the equipment level on the tanks being better.
Yes, yeah.
And I think I've got bigger divisions, if that makes sense. Like, there's more stuff in each one.
I think so, yeah.
But it was the other thing to say, because it was all focused up on that northern bit, I did detach the 11th Hussars.
You did.
In their recon. They have 45 CPA, which is nuts.
Just more truck bandit stuff that I'm not happy about.
Yeah, and fired them across. They like went round here, four divisions, and went into that supply dump.
Yeah.
Like, captured a truck convoy.
Wasn't happy about that. However,
and
there is...
bombed by... the other half of my fleet bombed that supply dump and destroyed 10%.
Yes, you've captured a trio of heavy trucks that was sitting at supply dump one, which is the one supplying the wall. And the 11th showed up. They have those trucks. They've just watched it get blown, not quite to smithereens, but blown slightly to smithers.
Also, the bad bit you were going to have is, because there was 176 ammo in it, right?
That sounds right.
That's thirded.
Yes.
And then when you recapture it, it's thirded again.
Yes.
So there'll be 20?
That sounds about right. Yeah, I mean, what's that third? Would be 60.
So it goes
60, 20.
20, yeah.
I think it's less than 20.
Yeah, 18, 19.
Oh, no. So yeah, I'm going to have absolutely no ammo from that. That is worth using. That's enough for a few barrages.
20 is some of mine can't do. That's 5 2-point of artillery. A lot of them are like 6.
Yeah, so it's very much a case of if I want to hold that line, I'm going to have to start resupplying with ammo again, and I'm going to have to get rid of these 11th. I do have a plan for that.
Yeah,
I do have a plan to squash these new wave of truck bandits.
I mean, that makes sense, yeah.
And I have another plan, which I think I'm going to go for.
Is this the one where it would ruin everything? Or
no, I've came up with a new plan today that you inspired. That is going to be quite a frustrating one for you to watch unfold.
Is it to do with the Saharan?
It might be. It depends what flavor of mischief I want to go for. If I want to go for risky mischief or just overt wacky mischief.
Yeah.
But all in all, I think that was a very good session.
It is making me wish I'd gathered my guys and pushed earlier, because if I'd done this in turn 2 when you had your supply issues,
yes,
like none of them could have got involved in the fighting and it would have just been a rollover.
If I had motorized these guys from the start and just drove them along that northern road from upstage 2, you would be absolutely fucked.
Yeah.
So
probably, yeah.
Watch this space in the full game.
Because you've got 11 divisions on the map at the minute, right?
That sounds right.
Which is double mine.
Yeah. Yeah, so
triple.
If I motorized a bunch of those, 3 or 4 of them, stuck them on that northern road, and just bombed down the coast towards you, I don't think you'd have enough time to get all of your men organized and in the same spot.
Probably not.
So then I could just start backfilling that position of forces.
Yeah.
And leave you on a very difficult straight.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, because next session we'll have our back half of this op stage.
We'll have my
movement and combat, yeah.
And I do have a plan. It's going to be, as always, a risky one. And I think this one, it has to be more careful than I anticipated it being. I don't think it's going to be as violent as this op stage was from your side.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be more positioning and getting ready for a fight.
Yeah.
I think next op stage is going to be where that fight really comes to a head. I think what I'm going to do might force you into a position where retreat is removed as a viable option.
Interesting to see what that is.
It's a bit of a two-pronged plan. Both prongs need to work for anything to come to fruition. If either part of this plan fails,
yeah,
then the whole thing falls apart. So we'll see how that goes. But that's where we are, and it's a far cry from last week, I gotta say. Last week's episode was a very different mindset for me, and now I'm feeling another second wind is what I've gained, Andy.
It's good. We need that.
We do. I've got another sense of purpose instilled in me when it comes to this game. I'm ready for it. I'm ready. I'm raring to go. I'm willing. I'm able.
I'm excited to see what you've got up your sleeve.
I have a pink t-shirt up my sleeve, Andy. I'm wearing a hoodie, and I've got a white t-shirt on, which I washed with red clothes, so it's become a pink t-shirt. Always got to separate them. Separate your washing, people. That's a cautionary tale from me. But when it comes to cautionary tales, we can't just take our own advice, Andy. We should take advice from those listening, because they have plenty to say that we couldn't possibly know about unless they were to beam it over to us through the internet. And that's exactly what people have done.
Do you enjoy learning about the stuff they send in?
They have beamed little bits and bobs over to us. So, what do we have here? There's a web form, I believe, you have for us, Andy.
Oh, we're starting with the web form?
I say, let's get this web form done. We need to churn through these web forms. We've got a bit of a backlog going.
So if you have sent in a web form and we've not read out for a while, we're going to start moving through them, so it should be up soon. The first one's coming from Andrew, though.
You just wrote this yourself, then?
Yeah, it was me testing the form, and the message is, test.
Oh, cool. I guess that one's open to interpretation.
Hey, Cunningham, when you mentioned that Cunningham had been promoted to Admiral, I wonder if he skipped Commodore. I don't think he did. I think I just didn't mention it. and raised his flag on HMS Hood. I was momentarily alarmed. that thing had a date with the KMS Bismarck, remember? We're lucky he moved on to other things before that happened. The hood was the elephant in the room when everyone sat down, signed the Washington Naval Treaty. Head and shoulders bigger than the next biggest battle wagon in the British fleet. Even at the start of World War II, it was handily bigger than capital built ships built since the treaty. Might actually do an episode about that treaty, because it really shapes the entire naval structure. Because after World War I, they all get together and like hammer out who can have a navy and what can be in it.
Yeah, I know a little bit about that. That's one of the sort of tertiary bits of history I do know a little bit about.
Yeah, and it's all weird. Like, you can have, I think it's something like 70,000 tons of aircraft carrier.
That's like a weird way for them to measure it.
Yeah, it's...
So you got a really light aircraft carrier.
Yeah, you could get a bunch of, like, very flimsy ones, I guess.
Some plywood, some styrofoam. I'm sure that was available in the early 30s.
Well, that treaty might be the reason. Have you seen the ice ships that got prototyped?
No.
They, like, mix some weird compound and, like, straw and stuff with ice to reduce its, like, melting point further. And then, like, built ships and, like, floating platforms out of them. I don't think I ever got past the, like, prototype, like, here's an idea stage. But there were ice ships.
I mean, all I picture there is just a comical scene of an aircraft trying to land, and it just slides off the edge.
But, yeah, I think I might have stepped on Andrew's toes here. But sidebar, this is how the US Navy started World War II, with two ridiculously large aircraft carriers. They were building two battle cruisers to outmatch the hood. And then when the treaty showed that they would need to scrap them, the builder's yard quickly pivoted and said, these things, oh, no. These are going to be those new aircraft things, aircraft carrier things that have just been invented that the treaty doesn't cover because they're new.
Ah, classic loopholes.
Yeah. Because with Cunningham being mentioned, Cunningham launched the first aircraft carrier attack against a fleet in port. Like that, the first one of them that ever happens during World War II against the Italians.
So it's a real turning point in that sense.
Yeah, and sort of defined naval power for till now.
I mean, yeah, that's still, yeah, they haven't really gone past that.
The aircraft carrier was sort of still the crown jewel for power projection. Also, Andrew's harangue app idea is genius, and here's the web form he asked us to try. Although I'm super interested in military history and old Hex and Counter games, I would never have been a soldier of any type. I'm noisy, manic, and way too cowardly. Don't be so dour yourself, Andrew, but thanks for the message. Good stuff in there.
I think that's a play on subtle, humble, brave.
It is. I do enjoy seeing when people do the flip and like what, especially what's opposite, subtle.
Yes, what the antithesis of subtle, humble, and brave that comes to people's mind is always a fun one to explore. But if you're listening to this, Andrew, and again, I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt that this isn't just you sending this, Andy. if this is a real person doing it, then don't put yourself down like that. If it's actually just you, Andy, you should put yourself down a little bit more.
Further.
Yes. You want to be subterranean the way you're going on here, especially after what you've done today. I hope you know that despite my energy having picked up, I do not forgive you.
That's fine. That is how this works.
That's very fair. We've got another one, so thank you for that, Andrew. Moving on, we have Milan. Milan has been in touch via traditional email and says, "Hey, Andy and James, Milan from Texas here again. I have just finished episode 54 and wanted to give you guys some cool few verses, a few versus many stories from World War II, which we asked for last week.
Yes.
I've included links to Wikipedia and other related media for each one that I know off the top of my head. So we have here three different examples. Number one. During the German invasion of Poland, the Battle of Wisna saw less than 1,000 Polish defenders delay a German force of 40,000 for several days before finally surrendering. This is despite not only being outnumbered, but also outgunned, and it took them running out of ammunition before surrendering."
That's very impressive. Also, the surrender is, we can't hurt you anymore, so we're going to... It's not...
Yeah, it's there is no
like
alternative
breaking of will or anything. It's like, fuck, we actually can't.
Yeah, by the nature of the situation, everything is a surrender at that point. There's no action they can take other than throwing furniture at the enemy. That isn't just surrender by its nature.
But I'll definitely have a look at that, because that's it.
Outnumbered.
Huge.
40-1
yeah.
is insane.
This is, I guess we'll get into it. This is what I was thinking we would get with... we'd get a lot of outnumbered defenders.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I think there's something special about the being outnumbered and then while you're the like aggressor going on the attack.
Yes, that's a very rare scenario.
Yeah.
Which I guess we've seen now historically.
Yeah.
But yeah, for the most part you're gonna be able to defend something with less men a lot easier than you are wiping out an enemy force actively.
Yeah.
As an aggressor. That's one I'll have to look into as well. But I'm sure with it being part of World War II, that could well be a history segment.
We also get Polish units in the North African theatre, so there might be...
Oh, there could actually be some crossover directly.
Yeah.
Number two, the Battle of Castle Itter saw just a few dozen soldiers and civilians with small arms defend Kassel in Austria against 150 to 200 German SS soldiers that had mortars, machine guns, and even anti-tank guns. The real twist of the battle was that the defenders were made up of an American tank crewman, Wehrmacht soldiers with their major, an SS officer, French civilians, including a famous, at the time, tennis player who played a key role in the battle.
I did some light research into this because this piqued my curiosity. This is an amazing piece of history that will 100% be getting an episode or a series. It's because as well as there being the French tennis player in there, there's also a former president of France.
Oh, wow.
There's like a bunch of high-level prisoners. And as it's... There's an SS officer fighting the SS. It's, I think, only twice the Americans and Germans ever fought like alongside each other in the war, and this is one of them.
Yeah, that's bizarre. I'm going to have to look at... Well, I imagine, again, this could be a history segment, so I'll not do too much of a deep delve. I like learning through the lens of history segments. But that is one that is particularly strange to imagine. I just can't imagine how that came about.
It happened in this weird end phase of the war.
Right.
I think it happened like 2 days after Hitler killed himself and 4 days before the end of the war, or so in like a very weird tight time scale where like the German... army and SS had like broken into like regional things where people are like scrambling to get to the Americans to surrender to them, not the Russians, and like some SS like this are going to castles to like execute everyone before they lose the chance, and it's like a very chaotic time within a chaotic
so it's like, very much last chance saloon. If you want to make one crazy move, this is the time to do it.
The train's off the tracks. There's like one thing you can do, and it's like what people chose to do with that.
Yeah, it's sort of you know, you see a meteor coming to Earth, what do you do on your last day?
Yeah.
That kind of situation. And a tennis player, former French president, and an SS soldier have apparently all come together with the same idea.
To defend a castle.
That sounds like some sort of Netflix original film.
This could be a film, definitely.
I'd probably give that one a watch, maybe on a Sunday afternoon when hungover. And the third example is the defense of Shanghai in the Chinese theater. Its own research topic, but in particular, the defense of the warehouse is a story that needs to be told more often. A brutal battle that culminated in the Chinese retreat from the city. However, it is special in that a few hundred Chinese soldiers held the line for days against an overwhelming Japanese attack, long enough to allow their forces to retreat from the city. The warehouse was also situated across a small river from the foreign section of the city, so you can actually find recorded footage of the attack taken by journalists that were staying at the embassies and hotels in Shanghai.
I mean, that's insane as well.
That would be wild to see footage of that as well.
Yeah. And that is a part of it, because we've sort of mentioned the four theaters, but like I've never really looked into the what's going on in the Pacific that's not the Americans fighting the Japanese imperial stuff, and them trying to take Manchuria and stuff like that. Like,
that's all I ever really picture when it comes to that. I don't think I've ever looked into anything involving China in World War II.
Well, yeah, I mean, they kind of had a, they got a rough deal. There's like the Rape of Nanking.
Yes.
Occupied by the Japanese for a while. And not a nice occupation by any means. Like,
well, that's, I think that's part of why I've never wanted to look into it, because all I understand of it is just horrors.
Yeah.
And not the sort of ones where it's like, oh, this huge battle took place and devastating losses on both sides. All I know about it is like Nanking, where it's like, oh, so atrocities committed
it's
against
described as
civilians.
The rape of, like, I don't think there's anything else that...
Yeah, and if that's the adjective that describes the event happening to a location or a population, yeah. I'll be honest, it's not really a portion of history that is then going to tickle my fancy in research. I'll just get sad.
I think it was grim, but I'm going to be looking into it more.
Yeah, I mean, in a history segment, I wouldn't turn my nose up at learning more. I think it's such a grim thing to spend time alone researching. I can't do that.
Yeah.
So if you're going to do a research section on that, props to you, buddy, because that's going to be a horrible night's research.
Well, it's sort of horrible, all of it, when you look into it. It's the same reason I've not gone too far into the Eastern Front stuff, because the sort of bullet point contents page of that is horrific.
Well, yeah, it must read like a fucking horror story for the most part.
And you've got things like the Duralange Brigade, which is an insane thing.
I don't even think I know that one.
It's a penal legion, so it's made up of criminals.
Oh, okay.
In the SS.
Right.
And it was responsible for, like, doing pogroms and stuff on the Eastern Front, but, like, not the industrialized Holocaust, but, like, just go into a village and kill everyone, then go to the next village. It's just horrible.
Very manual genocide.
Yeah, and it's, like, the people who were, like, criminal scum to the Nazis were like, let's harness these people. It's, like... That's a scary group.
Yeah, let's make them radical fascists.
Yeah.
Send them overseas and see what they do. And I imagine the result is, well...
It's nightmarish.
Heinous activity. Brilliant. Well,
it's almost like we picked an incredibly grim subject to do a podcast about.
Yeah, you know, I always let that get away from me a little bit. I'm like, oh, wacky board game. Oh, wait, no, sorry, World War II board game. Oh, yeah, World War II. Ah, yeah, atrocities.
Yeah.
I always forget how few degrees there are that separate whimsical podcasts from atrocities in history.
It's no degree. They're butting against each other.
Yeah, the degree, it's just the next guy.
Yeah.
But the email closes off from Milan. As an aside, the whole Chinese theater is something I've been reading about for the past year. It is unlike any other part of the war in a way I can't describe. Sounds what we've just talked about there. If you're getting more interested in the history of World War II, I have to recommend checking out the information on that theater and what happened. Anyway, these three popped into my head as I was listening, so please enjoy Milan from the desert of my mind.
Thanks, Milan. That was three really good bullet points that I'll reach something to, like, just interesting to look at. So thank you very much for that.
Yeah, awesome examples, and also, some more thought-provoking aspects of stuff to look into and stuff I sort of fear learning about, but stuff that is, by the merit of it, important to learn about. I guess if I'm committing to the podcast and the game, I just have to accept learning about stuff like this.
Some things that make you sad.
Yeah. I mean, I've learned some things in the game today that made me sad, but I guess speaking of learning about things that make me sad, Andy, what do you got for me today in the history segment?
What I have for you is we're continuing the 7th.
The 7th have plagued me all day today, so why not plague the history segment as well? At least this time it's the real ones and not the ones that you've co-opted into some sort of tool to harass me through the medium of a board game.
Well, if anything, they're underpowered in the game.
Get on with your history.
Yeah. I find this army and its famous commander with a record of victory behind it, which was undoubtedly played a decisive part in altering the whole character of the war. That's another quote from... I think the 7th's number one fan, Winston Churchill.
He likes them. He does.
He's a big fan of them.
He's got a lot of good stuff to say about them, and I can't understand why in the game, but in history, of course.
Oh, yeah. So the 14th of February, 1941, after Operation, 7 days after Operation Compass, comes to an end. The 11th Hussars.
Oh, yes, great. You bring them all out.
Encounter a new enemy in the theater as three Messerschmitts come over the horizon and attack them.
Oh,
they do manage to shoot down one of the planes, but the other two escape. In fact, the two planes that survive swing around and machine gun the crashed plane before leaving.
What? Why?
I guess to, like, knock it out and, fully destroy it.
Oh, that's odd.
Yeah. They don't manage to do that, though, and the crew of two from the crashed plane do survive the crash. And the 11th recovered documents that outlined the route the planes had taken to get to North Africa.
Ah, right, that'll be why then.
Yeah, and also information about hotels in Naples. It was apparently worth mentioning in the thing I was reading, but didn't go into why.
Just, you know, the kind of stuff you find in the glove compartment from months ago.
Yeah. So the 2nd Armored Division has come in and they're responsible for holding the ground that's been gained in Compass. Although half of it has been detached and has gone to Greece, so it's understrengthed. Rommel's Africa Corps, supported by the Luftwaffe, starts to advance, easily dealing with the forces trying to stop them. The joint German and Italian offensive is called Operation Sunflower. It's a nice name.
Yeah, that sounds quite nice.
Yeah.
Between Compass and Sunflower, the names themselves don't sound particularly ominous.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to look at how they come out of them.
Just the most disarming name they can think of.
But this is very successful, and by the 15th of April, the front is all the way back to Sollum, so back on the border.
Yeah, that's a push.
Although Tobruk is holding out against siege.
Okay.
It's surrounded, but the front, they just sort of moved past it. But while all this is happening, the 7th is being refit in Cairo. They're struggling to get back up to strength because there's more pressing need for equipment in places like Greece, so they're not a priority at the time.
You would have thought they'd delegate some to them because of what they managed to pull off and how dire things are with a push that far east again.
Yeah, I think they will get some, but I think it's like we're actively fighting the invasion of Greece and stuff right now.
Yeah, whereas this is just a pendulum swing.
Yeah, there's also a political element where, like, to Greece to come into the war on the Allies' side, they needed to have a certain amount of troops sent to them.
Yeah.
So the first guys to, like, get back out there are get out in early April from the 7th. It's the 1st King's Royal Rifle Company and the 11 Hussars. The 11th are training a South African Armoured Car Regiment. So they're more in a training role than at the front.
Okay.
But the King's Royal Rifle, they get to the front and they start separating into small groups and raiding across the lines looking for convoys. These will be called Jock Columns after Jock Campbell, which are like small groups of motorized soldiers, artillery and tanks that operate to spread across like a wide area and like try and find vulnerable points.
Okay, yeah.
These are successful at first, but eventually run into problems dealing with Rommel's armor, as Rommel tends to keep his tanks together to be like a decisive hammer blow.
Right.
Where, like, he even set comments on British tank tactics to a captured British tank commander. What difference does it make to me if you have two tanks to my one? If you send them out and let me smash them in detail, you presented me with three brigades in succession. So it's like,
I can
as
power
many small chunks as you want.
Yeah, if you're not setting them all collectively, I'll just pick them apart.
Yeah.
It's a divide and conquer, but they're doing the divide for you.
Yeah. Because it worked well against the Italians.
I mean, yeah, that's because they have papier-mâché tanks.
Yeah, and they have like a very defensive mindset, but then Rommel comes in and he's the aggressor, and it does let you get away with more stuff.
Yes.
So on the 15th of May, the British all launch another operation called Operation Brevity, which is...
Now, that's funny based on how short Compass was meant to be and how it ended up being. So,
Well, this one was meant to relieve Tobruk by taking some territory close to the border and like pulling troops from it and eventually getting up to Tobruk. But it failed after 3 days.
Oh.
Sort of a reverse compass where it was like, this is going to push them back and looking at, oh no, it's going to end after 3 days.
Yeah, because by historical precedent of scaling, it would mean that they take all of Africa.
Yeah.
But apparently not.
Then they have another go with Operation Battle Axe, which is a bigger offensive with which sort of the same goals, but it also fails. And then the 7th in particular suffer a rough thing here, where on the 27th of June, they suffer a friendly fire disaster as a group of RAF bombers accidentally bomb them near Mersa Matruh.
Oh, shit.
They lose 359 lives, and God, almost twice that many are injured, which, just to put it in perspective, is almost comparable to the amount of damage they took through all of Operation Compass.
I was going to say, that's massive. Yeah. What kind of bombing run was that? Like, how many planes were involved? Do you know?
I think it was Vickers bombers. It said the raid took place over 2 hours.
How the fuck do you not realize after the first 10 minutes what's going on?
Yeah, or like someone gets on the radio or something, but...
Like, do you... Because, I can't picture in my head how different the planes look if you're, like, on the ground. So were they firing back at the planes as well, do you think, which just exacerbated the issue?
Or... I don't know. I'll look into it more, but... Because I have seen, like, they could identify planes by the sort of silhouette, and in particular when they get closer, like, engine sounds.
Yeah.
But I don't know how the... Because I think bombing is pretty imprecise from the air in terms of you're like this map grid coordinate, go and drop bombs near it. Because
yeah,
you can't be like, strike this building, they're just not accurate enough at this time.
Yeah, so it's a case of you're going to try and sweep an area.
Yeah.
But you'd think that one side would, whether it's the air or the land, would
figure
at some point
out,
see what's going on. But again, if you're being bombed, I mean, that's very naive of someone who's never been under bomb fire.
Yeah.
So,
and I don't know the conditions, like if there's a sandstorm and you've got like a layer between you,
yeah, and you're just hearing the planes and then just,
yeah,
seeing bombs exploding, and then on the other side you're just seeing like silhouettes on the ground and you're like, well, there's something around here that
we're
meant to
bomb. Told to go here by someone or,
but that many losses,
yeah,
that's a devastating hit,
really bad. Regardless, the next major action they'll see was Operation Crusader during November and December. This was another operation planned to relieve Tobruk. So Tobruk as well is holding out for like 9 months.
That's wild.
Yeah. This is when the Desert Rats will face the 21st Panzer Division.
Oh, now that's a showdown that will be quite the fiery one.
Yes, at an airfield called Sidi Rezegh, which will get its own episode in detail, but sort of moving through the 7th. This is on the road, it's south of the road that goes between Badr and Tobruk. The British come in and they capture this airfield. And at this point, their commander elects to hold the position rather than keep advancing. And yeah, it's the British playing the cautious defensive role. Rommel, however, despite depleted ammo and fuel, does send his panzers to go and have this, which is one of the major tank battles. It does have a bit of an effect that the British are looking for, because the panzers were taken from around Tobruk, so it has relieved some of the pressure on Tobruk, with the Germans having to react to it.
Okay.
So, in the early afternoon of the 22nd of November, Rommel attacks the airfield. Fighting is desperate here. I think 3 Brits earn Victoria Crosses in this one engagement.
So it's an intense one then.
Yeah, including Jock Campbell, who like rides in his car and then his car is slower than the tanks. So he's just jumping on, holding onto the outside of one of the tanks, like directing the battle.
Oh,
like
that's badass.
It's some full on like war hero stuff going
that's
on.
Metal as fuck.
So the 21st Panzers have considerably weaker numbers, but just superior in both the tanks and also combined arms tactics. Because the problem the Brits have, they've not used combined arms during Operation Compass, and they sort of got away with it.
Mm.
And then this is them like reaping the like overconfidence almost.
Yes.
So after 3 days, they do push the 7th Armored Division back. The 7th the 7th Armoured Brigade withdrew, which is part of the 7th here. It had 4 of its 150 tanks remain operational.
Whoa, so that is... They're done. They're out of order now, yeah. Completely.
In 4 days during Operation Crusader, the 8th Army, which is like the overall one the 7th is part of, lost 530 tanks, and the Axis lost 100.
Oh, so that ratio has swung completely.
Back the other way, yeah. It isn't a total loss, however, because it does sort of bloody the nose of, like, the aura of invincibility Rommel had. Like, despite him winning, it's the first time there's, like, Rommel's taking substantial losses as well.
Yeah, because that's not nothing.
No,
100 over 100 tanks is, that's a significant number to lose. It's just that it paid off in the ratio that he's getting back.
Yeah. So I'm going to speed up here. So throughout 1942, the 7th take part in the first and second battles of El Alamein and then the Tunisia campaign. They take over Tripoli in January. So throughout that year, it swings back and forth. I'm thinking, same way I highlighted Operation Compass with the 7th, I'll do like each of these operations I'm mentioning in the battles of El Alamein, but sort of focus in on them with a different... Because I could have done this with just the 7th because they were in it, but then the series would be just the history of the North Africa campaign.
Yes, through the eyes of the 7th.
Yeah. So, but they get into a race where the 7th is racing against the 2nd to see who can capture Tunis first.
It's a fun game.
Yeah. They won. The 11th Hussars again enter the city first on the 7th of May. Fighting in North Africa comes to an end on the 13th of May, 1943.
Wow, that's a long-ass battle.
And it wouldn't be part of this series without mentioning a crazy number of POWs being taken.
Naturally.
In this case, it's 250,000 Axis soldiers surrender.
Jesus Christ.
The 7th take part in the Italian campaign as well, but they're not there for the initial landing because they're in Syria training for amphibious landings. Which will be pretty important later. They don't have a good time in Italy. It's described this. There could be no greater contrast to the desert. We struggled forward, blown bridges and muddy vineyards, causing more delay than opposition from the enemy. Like, it's a wet winter in Italy as well.
Complete flip.
Yeah. In December 1943, the 7th hand over all its vehicles and equipment to the 5th Canadian Armoured Division, and head back to Britain, arriving in Glasgow in early January, where they'll start making preparations for D-Day.
Oh.
Pick it up there next time.
And that, I can imagine, is going to be another significant slice of history that they're involved in.
Yes. I mean, they go from... It's amazing. They go from, like, fighting at the very start to, like, going into Berlin.
Yeah, that's... Like, yeah, you're very much seeing it through start to finish.
Yeah.
You can't really get much more definitive closure than going to Berlin for what is the culmination of it all.
Which is why I sped it up a bit, because it would just be the history of World War II. These guys are that, like, crucial and involved.
Well, at least we'll get some cameo appearances from them in future episodes. Cause,
they'll definitely be back.
Yeah, I mean, all these other battles that they've been part of.
I mean, Jock Campbell, who I mentioned getting the Victoria Cross and being the leader of the 7th support group, he'll just get his own episode by himself. A couple of other guys in the 7th just as individuals.
From what you said there, that description of him just hanging onto the side of the tank is, I mean, what a cinematic little flashy guy this guy is.
Oh, yeah.
I think the fact that there's such a big pushback from Rommel and the Panzers gives me confidence that my tanks in the end, well, not in the end, but maybe partway through the game, will have their day in the sun. And it is a hot desert sun that they'll be under.
And I think you'll have it for quite a good chunk, and then Lend-Lease and the Shermans and stuff will show up. But not, again, it's the quote about, it's similar to the one Rommel had, but it's some German describing fighting American tanks, which is every Panzer is worth a... 4 American tanks, but they always have 5. It's just outproducing them.
Well, I look forward to having my my superiority finally shine through, because I've not done a great job with my air superiority. But maybe the tanks will be different.
Also, when your Messerschmitts show up, they're going to be a huge jump in quality.
That's a good point. I just need to hold out until the Germans show up, which unfortunately can't happen in the scenario that we're currently playing. But we're pretty much halfway through the scenario now, Andy.
Yeah.
That's good news. I mean, as of the end of next stop stage, we are halfway through, which means it's doable.
Well, it'll finish next year, ideally, so...
It will finish next year.
Midway through, yeah.
It will definitely finish next year. We're not doing this all the way through 2026. No fucking way. This scenario ends next year, and the main game starts.
Yes.
That's my resolution. That's my New Year's resolution. Finish this fucking scenario, finally.
There we go.
And then we'll get into the big leagues.
Big boy stuff.
No more training wheels, Andy. We'll be kicking them off. Yeah. Unscrewing them with an Allen key. Going big. And in order to do so, we're going to have to get along up until that point.
Going to have to maintain the friendship.
And the way you behave today is just unacceptable. Taking out my guys, overrunning me. You really think that's cool?
Yeah.
You think that's fine to do?
Yeah.
Well, I disagree.
I enjoyed it.
Well, in that case, we're going to have to try and find some sort of common ground.
Ooh.
And now for something nicer. A little oasis in the war. It's time for some common ground. I'm trying the intro for Common Ground. I'm recording. Maybe.
Yeah. What's this common ground you speak of?
Well, if you'd like some exposition, Andy, here it is. Common Ground is the segment each week in which you and I decide to discuss a topic and try and find an area in which we can agree on said topic. We alternate in picking the random area that we're going to be debating, and it's actually your turn this week to pick the common ground topic.
I've got one for you right here.
Let's hear it.
Shops aren't allowed to, specifically clothing shops, aren't allowed to size things themselves anymore.
Okay. That, I think at a glance I know what you're going for here, but I'm going to need some clarity just in case.
Size-wise, I fluctuate from like XL to double XL, sometimes triple X, but that's quite a range. And like, there's no indication from shops which, like, because I'm the same size, but it's like three sizes different. And I'm like, okay, if you guys haven't standardized this yourself already, I'm going to create a third-party agency. They're going to size everyone's clothes so it's consistent.
Yeah, you know what? I have a bit of an issue with this because
it means buying clothes online. Just almost impossible. Insanely pointless.
Well, I mean, I usually get like medium sized stuff. Yeah. And for the most part on me, it's kind of loose and baggy. Then sometimes I'm like, well, I want something a bit more sort of neat fitting, so I'll get small. And sometimes that works. Or sometimes I buy something and it's like a crop top on me. Or it's just super short on the sleeves.
Yeah.
So, because I'm quite tall, but slim, which means when I'm buying like a shirt or something, I'll buy it and the sleeves will be like halfway up my wrist, but then it'll fit the rest of me fine. Then other times it's completely okay. And by the same merit, if I want like a baggy jumper or something nice and warm for the winter, something to lay about in, I'll go for a large. And sometimes it's just a baggy jumper on me. And sometimes it looks like I'm a child wearing his dad's clothes and it's just way over the top. There's no sensible place in between. And especially when you've just got the vague small, medium, large.
Yes.
When it's just the size descriptor, I feel like there's too much wiggle room.
So I think,
pun intended,
they make the clothes and then this group come in and they're like the guys who rate movies who are like separate.
Oh, like the... not BAFTA.
You know the...
Yes. Why can't I think of the name? The one that rank the sort of like PG, 12, 15... Yeah. I can't remember the name of that now. But I know, yes, some sort of independent body.
Yes, whereas like you can make the clothes, but they'll come in and be like, well, you've said that's a large, but it's not, because we've got our like templates. Because it also means, I'm thinking, you can get, you know, like a thing of carpet samples or something for when you're like doing your house or whatever.
Yeah.
You buy like a pack and it's the t-shirts, all the standard t-shirt sizes, like just a plain...
Oh, okay.
And then you can like try the shirt on the t-shirt and it's because it's always fixed.
It will always fit.
Yes. So you've got the like measuring stick at home.
That's a brilliant idea. No, that's absolutely genius. Hang on a minute. Let's not release this episode. Let's release this as a business idea. I swear to God, if anyone listening releases this as some sort of business idea, we will hound you to the end of the earth for royalties. That is too good of an idea for us to not be credited. The War with a Mate is not just a podcast. It's also now the empirical measurement of clothes sizes across the globe. Yeah, that's... So, yeah, you'd have your... It's a bit like... I did this for jewellery once where...
The ring sizes.
Yes, the ring sizes where you've got A to Z.
And you can get the little packs where it's got, like, with something, like, cheap, like, wire or something.
Yeah, it's
but it's got a range of them.
The one I had, yeah, it's just, like, a massive, like, a comedically big key ring with just little, like, loops of metal. So that, that you just slide them on and then you know what the ring size is. It's... Because I don't understand entirely how dress size works. For, you know, like women's clothes, like, I don't know if it just applies to dresses, but you've got dress sizes where it's like...
I don't understand how there's a zero.
I was just about to say I don't get that either. I don't understand how it can start at size zero.
Yeah.
Because for me, that's like...
It's like getting jeans which are size... It's like, there's no way for your torso to go into them.
Yeah, because it's like a category. Because then you've got... Because there's the whole thing
then
of...
Because then surely there must be minus... Two for someone who's smaller than a zero?
Well, it must be, because is a plus size model someone who's just a positive number?
Above zero?
Like two onwards.
Oh, I don't... It might be where that term like comes from, maybe.
Because if that's the case, then... Because from what I understand, size zero is like very, very like slim.
Yeah.
So I don't really understand how that scale works. So maybe this could be applied to dresses as well. I don't know if that system works very well or not, but we'll look into it as part of our expanding research to see how the market needs our attention. But I think this idea of having a much broader scale, because if dress sizes have 0, 2, 4, whatever, I think they go up in 2s. Because whatever that goes up to, whatever that goes down below 0 to, I think we need to have a broader scale for men's clothes or just unisex clothes in general.
Because I also found out something when I went to America to see my family and I wanted to buy jeans, which is apparently, you know, the like waist sizes you've got.
Yeah.
I think in like Britain, they're like 4 inches smaller than that. Or like two, like a certain amount smaller than that, typically. And in America, they are as well, but it's like a bigger number. Because like as everyone's got fatter... So people don't feel... So they're like, if you get a 40-inch like or 30-inch like waist on your jeans, it's not 30 or 40.
It's actually...
That shifted as well. And that depends like where you buy them and also the like region you're in.
But that's a measurement. That's actual distance measured.
Yes, but it's become like a brand... That's branding so fucking thing stupid. Where it's like... They've added the like psychology of like how people... It's like, no, let's standardize.
I don't care what the number is. I just want to know it's the correct number.
Yeah.
It can be 100 inches.
It's sort of a ridiculous thing of like, oh, you still go up when you gain weight.
Yeah.
It's not...
It's still going to increase.
Yeah.
What are you comparing it to? Because at that point, it's a measurement that at one point has become obfuscated from reality. So then it's just a different standard that you're measuring it by. So going up from that is just confusing.
Yeah,
because I think I'm a 32 is what I usually go for waist.
Yeah.
So does that mean I'm actually 36?
I think so. I'm not 100% on that, but I do know there's like a
differential that is adjusted for. That's so fucking stupid.
Yeah. So we're just standardizing all of it, and having a sizing agency.
Yeah. No, that's good. We're going to get some sort of governing body on this because there's no way that this is reasonable. This isn't. You know what? This isn't a controversial take at all on your part. You've done a couple of these in a row now where I'm on this. This is correct. It's a good way to do common
it's
ground.
It's moved from common ground to me doing Dragon's Den pitches,
where it's always a good business idea. You're doing was it reggae sauce?
Yeah, that was the big breakout from Dragon's Den, I think.
Yeah, and that's what this is. This is another Dragon's Den breakout hit, Andy. This is just fantastic. Yeah. I think
I'd love to just have a draw where it's all
the sizing clothes,
t-shirts, shirts, trousers, like, but just like maybe even just like grey sweatpants. It's not that you wear.
Yeah, they're just templates.
Yeah.
The thing is, I know for a fact I end up wearing them.
I would as well, but like, it would be good to have... Yeah.
I'd end up wearing the... It's a bit like getting
and stretching them.
It's like, you know, the training shield from Lumbridge on my RuneScape.
Yeah.
It's like when you carry that around, you get mocked for it.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, oh, he's wearing the template shoes. Oh, but then that would become a fashion statement, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
You're wearing the template clothes.
The, like, no brand branding type stuff.
I only wear the template clothes, guys. Well, don't. They dissolve in rain. That's how we get you.
Yeah.
And we make them expensive as well. So if you ever tear them or ruin them, you have to buy another set, and it's going to be costly.
Well, you'd also go on and you'd just buy the range here. So you would get, like, small, medium, and then maybe a large.
Yeah, but I'm not going to buy, like, the full kit where it goes up to, like, 5XL.
And, like, 5XS. Like.
Yeah, because if I got to either of those, I've had a huge change in physiological shape.
Going to that is, like, you're... That's a bone structure change.
Yeah,
that's
at that point, like... the shape of my body's changed. It's not weight. It's height.
Yeah.
I've lost inches. Right, yeah. I don't think there's really anything I can add to that as a criticism. I've got the clarity I needed. I've got my wallet here ready to invest. I think this is just a spot-on idea, and we need to get in touch with... I don't know who's in charge of this at the moment.
I don't know how you set up a third-party agency that...
regulate stuff.
Yeah.
I think you have to petition to the government.
Yeah.
Right, so we'll write a letter to Starmer. We'll let him know that there's a need for this. I imagine there'll be a lot of red tape to cut through, but it's important to.
We'll fast track it. It'll be in the next budget.
I'd buy so many clothes online if I had this.
Yeah.
The only thing I bought online clothing-wise, I bought two things. I bought a jacket from Wish when we lived together years ago.
That fit surprisingly well.
That jacket lasted, it cost £4.50, and I wore it for about 8 years. It was a leather jacket, well, faux leather, and it was amazing. I loved that jacket. I've still got it somewhere. It's very worn down now. It started to fall apart after a while. The pockets opened up and fell apart.
To be fair, though, like, a Wish thing is definitely, you think it's going to be like, you wash it twice. So again, 8 years, that's like what you'd get out of an actual good jacket.
It was my go-to jacket. It was incredible. Yeah. So durable. I got compliments on it once at a nightclub, and I offered to just give it away. And they were like, no, you can't give that away. I was like, the pockets are falling apart. If you want it, you can just have it. I'm really warm anyway. They didn't take it. And the other thing I bought was, it was in the same place we lived together. I bought that Spider-Man suit.
Which was for, like, a small, like a genuinely small child.
Yeah. Well, I bought it, and the sizing chart I used was, I was using it correctly, I think. But when it showed up, it was the black Spider-Man suit. It was for Halloween. I put it on, well, tried to put it on, and I realized that in order to do so, I would need to, I think, break my spine in two places and remove several vertebrae in order to fit into it. I tried, but I needed that spine. I'm too spined, Andy. I've got too much integrity. That's why I couldn't be that Spider-Man.
That's what it is, yeah.
Normal Spider-Man has integrity. When he's got the symbiote suit on, he's got no integrity. It was a metaphor. I bought a metaphor from Wish.
And couldn't fit, make it fit.
Well, I think that's it. I've spun some tales. I've reinvigorated myself with energy. I've agreed with your common ground. Andy, do you have anything else to add that you feel needs to be said today, other than, I guess, letting people know how to get in touch?
Yep. Please email in info@warofmate.co.uk. There's a contact form on the website, which is warofmate.co.uk. And there's an Instagram, which is just @warofmate.
It is indeed.
So, 3 points of contact there. Pick your favourite and fire something over it.
Yeah, it can be about the game, which is the thing we're most focused on. It can be about World War II, which we're also focused on. It can be about anything else, which we're not focused on, but boy, will we talk about it.
Oh, yeah. We love a bit of nonsense.
Oh, that's all we're doing. That's what this whole fucking thing is. It's nonsense. Start to finish. Desert of my mind. Subtle, humble, and brave.
Yep. Thanks for listening. Say subtle, humble, and brave. Stole my line.
I'll steal more than that, you son of a bitch. Good night.